Welcome to AMA Edgewise. I'm Dave Summers. AMA Edgewise is brought to you by the American Management Association. In publications such as Business Week and Fast Company, the media have celebrated Whirlpool's transformation into a leading-edge innovator, as well as Nancy Tennant Snyder's role as Chief Innovation Officer. Her new book, Unleashing Innovation, co-written with Deborah L. Duarte, tells the inside story of one of the most successful innovation turnarounds in American history. Nancy Tennant Snyder reveals how Whirlpool undertook one of the largest change efforts in corporate history and shows how innovation has been embedded throughout the company, which ultimately led to bottom-line results. Welcome to the program.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
We're pleased to have you here because of the significant impact you had at Whirlpool. Now, lots of companies are looking for answers on how to innovate. First of all, what is embedded innovation?
Embedded innovation, especially for a company as established and old as Whirlpool, is about trying to change the infrastructure, the things inside a company that drive performance so that employees and people within the company can be innovative. And it also is about making sure that you can do that for the long term. So it's about sustaining that. We find a lot of companies can do it once or twice, do a project, and do very well. The really hard part is how do you do it over several years and how do you involve everyone in the process?
When did you begin the program?
We started in 1999, which has been a while, because of a strategic shift at the company. We were in a commodity industry and trying to really think about how can we create an internal growth engine for the company. Our executive committee started thinking about innovation, but our previous chairman, David Whitwam, had a very novel idea in 1999. He believed that innovation could come from everywhere and everyone. And in 1999, that was not necessarily the conventional wisdom. If you just think about what was happening with the internet, and we were opening business journals every day and seeing individual geniuses that had innovated something and thinking about how to bring that inside a company and opening that up for everyone, no matter what level or function or background, was a very novel idea. And that was the charter that he gave me and a group of people inside Whirlpool to try to understand how to do that.
How did you begin?
We started by looking around the world to see who was doing anything like this or pieces of it. We brought in several big consulting groups. But again, in 1999, innovation was not necessarily a big practice around the world. It's only been within the last 5 or 6 years that you see the big consulting companies in it. So it's hard to find a consulting company that shared our values and our belief, and one that we felt comfortable in working with for a very short period of time. We started by doing some research. We brought some consulting companies in, and we landed on Gary Hamel's group, Strategos.
And was that the way you developed the framework for the embedded innovation, or were there stages before then?
They really came in and helped us with a toolkit and a set of processes that everyone could use, no matter what your level or background. We started trying to understand, how do you go in and re-engineer the company to be able to allow innovation to succeed? And that work was more trial and error. That was getting in there, trying some things. Most of it didn't work, and coming back and rethinking it and trying it again. And that took several years for us to really figure out how to move forward.
I'm interested in the word re-engineer because that's exactly what you did, right?
It's kind of a hard word, and it doesn't necessarily go with innovation. When you think about innovation, you think about creativity and freedom and no sandbox. But in fact, when you're a company as old as Whirlpool, 100 years old almost, you have all these embedded business systems and management systems that really were designed to limit risk, to look at cost and quality, and for a variety of other strategic purposes. When you introduce innovation into the mix, you have to go in and make all of those systems visible and re-engineer them. That is the really hard work for innovation. That's the not fun part of it.
Was the toolkit, the architecture, the iPipeline, the iMentor, something you brought into the mix?
No, the toolkit that we licensed from Strategos is a set of tools that teams can use that start with an ideation process by looking at expanding ideas through different tools like a migration path to take an idea and understand how big the idea can be, and then to begin a selection process through experimentation in the marketplace and ultimately through launch. So that was the toolkit, developing the innovation pipeline, developing the innovation mentors. Everything else was on top of that.
What was the pipeline exactly?
The pipeline started by us not having a pipeline. If you think about literally a company that had pockets of innovation, but not very many, you have to engineer a pipeline, starting with understanding what are the steps that an innovation process goes through. You can look at 3M and Procter & Gamble and all the great companies in the world, and there's a pretty similar set of steps, but then trying to understand how that is uniquely designed for Whirlpool to fit with our product development process, et cetera. How do you really go through a stage gate process but make sure you don't kill innovation and manage it ultimately as a portfolio of ideas so that you can begin to scale it, begin to understand the revenue it's going to generate into the future, et cetera. That took us a couple years to establish.
Very interesting.
The goal is to get ideas from everyone, and often that happens with people forming teams together around an idea that they're passionate about. And then bringing that idea to the pipeline, if you will, and going through a self-screening mechanism to understand, does that idea really fit the definition of innovation? That screening mechanism, that definition, is a big learning for Whirlpool. You have to have an operational definition of what is innovation that innovators can use to understand what's going to be funded and what's going to go through the innovation pipeline.
What is Whirlpool's definition of innovation?
At Whirlpool, we say it has three components. An idea or a product or service has to solve a customer problem, even an unarticulated need. It has to be very unique in the marketplace. It can't be like anything else, or at least be on a migration path that produces a cadence of unique ideas. And lastly, it has to garner above average premiums. The organization needs to bring a value to the consumers that they're willing to pay more for.
That's a tough screen to go through.
It's very tough. And what's really helpful as an innovator is often you can hit two of them. Okay, I've got this great idea. I think it's going to solve a customer's problem. And there's nothing like it in the marketplace. But guess what? I can't figure out how to make money. So you go into the toolkit, into a series of tools that we call the economic engine, that look at different ways that you can think about experimenting with an idea, a product or service to figure out how to make it profitable.
Nancy, who are the I mentors?
I think about them like Six Sigma black belts. They're highly trained individuals who volunteer to go through a very rigorous training process, and they are the group of people that facilitate teams through the tools and through the process. They're highly motivated. They work on all different kind of projects. They work on product projects. They work on marketing projects, wherever innovation is. And they're very, for me at least, inspirational. They're teachers and people with a lot of passion around innovation.
Are these individuals hired for the role?
No, they are people inside that are working in different jobs throughout the company and want to add to their career or develop a new career path for themselves. They're people that have full-time jobs that work around accounts payable or engineering or legal or wherever, but they also volunteer to help groups go through this innovation process.
Now, once you've been through the pipeline, you get to execution results, right?
Right.
But there is more to this because you have emotional drivers that make sure that this process works.
The emotional drivers were a nice surprise to me. When we started innovation in 1999, we weren't thinking about emotional drivers. We were, like any other large initiative, trying to figure out how to get it up and running. How do you build an iPipe? How do you train people, pay people? As we got going and we started to kind of hit a breakthrough, we started to see this amazing passion that was being unleashed in people that could come forward with ideas, felt the environment was safe and nurturing because we were training people and helping them connect with other people, and it unleashed an amazing emotional set of drivers that brought people to innovation.
For instance?
There's a lot of jobs in companies that you really don't have an opportunity to dream or to learn on. Innovation is uniquely positioned so that you can learn and bring your dreams to work and work on ideas that you have. So people that might be frustrated in one area of their career can come to innovation and try out things and learn things. So we began to see this unleashing of these emotional drivers of people who have a big need to learn and to contribute, to dream on the job and to see their dreams come to fruition. In Unleashing Innovation, I have a whole chapter on a group of people who came together to think about connectivity of appliances and how they can be really a unique offering in the kitchen, unlike anything we've seen with appliances. You also see a mythology of heroes that get created, because when you have innovation that's open to anyone, not just an elite few engineers or marketing people, you have a lot of people that come forward and can be successful and get some notoriety in the organization because they've beat the odds and they've brought an idea forward and it's had some modicum of success. You begin to see an interesting group of heroes that come forward that people talk about and emulate and want to meet. So there's that emotional driver as well. The last one is spirit. When you begin to start seeing results, and in a company where anyone can come forward and get help with an idea, the esprit de corps, the spirit that gets created, is like nothing I've ever seen in an organization, in an organization change effort.
Nancy, could you talk about the relationship between social networking and sustainable innovation?
When you think about unleashing innovation and opening it up for everyone, you basically take the controls off. You don't tell people what they have to innovate on. You don't send a memo out and say on Monday you're going to be innovative. You change the systems and you allow people to work on things that they're passionate about. And as they do that, they start finding other people who have the same passion. If you don't have a healthy social network that's controlled by the individuals and isn't controlled by the company, innovators will never find each other. And in a company as large as Whirlpool, and almost any company today, you need groups of people to innovate. It would be really difficult for one person to start with an idea and get it all the way through the system. So you need teams of people that come together that share a passion. Social network is a way for them to find each other and to begin to build on each other's ideas, which is what innovation is all about.
So that's part of the program.
Well, it is. I have a picture in the book that's kind of interesting. The picture has two social networks, one that's working and one that isn't working at all. And the social network that isn't working are pockets of two or three people talking just within their own pocket, but not sharing ideas across the value chain, let's say. It has to be part of it, but it also has to be something that isn't overly controlled by the company. We have to set up the conditions for it to flourish, but it really has to be something where innovators can find each other.
A lot of the people listening probably want to do something like embedded innovation. What are some of the obstacles they might encounter, and how could they avoid them?
You have to start out thinking about it as a system. If you say, we want innovation from everyone and we're going to train everyone, but you don't go into the management systems and re-engineer them so that people can be successful, then it's almost a morality issue. You're really not setting people up for success. The other side, if you go in and do all the systems work, but really don't train people and help people get the right skill set or meet other innovators, it's not going to work either. So you have to think about it as a whole system. And fortunately or unfortunately, the architect of that system has to sit pretty high up in the organization, because when you think about setting up seed funds and changing the way financial reporting works, that takes a lot of stroke in the organization to re-engineer that to allow innovation to flourish.
Now, you were the individual who did that, right?
I and a lot of other people. When we started innovation, I was the global head of innovation, but every Whirlpool is organized by region as an SBU or strategic business unit. Every region had an innovation head, and it took hundreds of people like me working every day trying to get it to work.
So it took a real commitment.
It did. A real commitment, not just in people, but in the long-term nature of it. And that's probably the other failure mode. It's going to be really hard to embed innovation in an organization of any size without having a long-term view. A lot of ours was having the long-term view, but a lot of it was luck as well. We've had two CEOs who've been very forceful and adamant about moving innovation forward. So we've been kind of lucky as well with the kind of people that we've had at the helm.
Nancy, how do you know when you get it right?
One way you know is there is a tipping point where you begin to see more resources coming out of it than you're putting in, and you begin to experience an excitement in the organization. But I'm not sure you ever know. I'm not sure you ever have it right. One of the things we say at Whirlpool is we're perpetually dissatisfied because the more we learn, the more we know we have to do, the more things we want to try. So I'm not sure if you ever really get it right, but I think you do hit a tipping point.
The title of the book is Unleashing Innovation, and one of the authors, Nancy Tennant Snyder, is here with us today. Nancy, thanks for being with us.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
As always, we'd love to get your feedback, so please drop us an email at podcast@amanet.org or call us at 800-697-3406. That's 800-697-3406. For more information on our executive conference centers and seminars, please visit our website, www.amanet.org. Thanks for taking us along. I'm Dave Summers, and you've been listening to AMA's Edgewise.